Hey, welcome to Crosstalk, the best recovery podcast that exists on the face of the interweb. Is that what they call it? The interweb? No, the World Wide Web? The internet? I'm not sure. But anyway, we are a great place for you to land today. Glad that you're here. I want to tell you to subscribe, like, give us your comments. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. I have a great guest today. I want you to understand that what we try to do in Crosstalk is get a cross-section of different people from different places in the world, different places in our country, and coming from different recovery stories. And we have a really brilliant guest today, Lisa Stanton. I want to welcome Lisa to our podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks for coming all the way to New York City to be on Crosstalk.
Yeah, it's good.
Glad you're here. So Lisa, I know you're in recovery.
Yep.
And you're kind of in the recovery business, which we'll hear about a little later on. But why don't you just start off, tell us a little bit about your story, how life started.
Yeah. So I live in Minnesota now, but I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is just an Amtrak ride away from here. So I was born originally to two parents. I have one older sister, 2 years older than me. Both parents I would describe as highly educated. My mom has a PhD from Princeton. My dad has a master's degree, a very just like upper middle class family. And I always say like nothing notable happened for the first few years of life that I know of, although I've come to learn in recovery that when I tell people my parents got divorced when I was five, I was like, there was no fighting, there was nothing. And I've had people be like, whether you saw fighting or not, the tension that a child can sense in a household that is falling apart is still palpable and something that I've gone back and looked at in recovery. But I wasn't really noticing it for the first few years of life.
What do you remember about those events? Were they things where dad left, you stayed home, or how did that look?
Yeah, it was very calm, like as divorces go. So I remember the day actually that my parents told me they were getting divorced. They put me and my sister on the little like L couch in our basement and came down and told us, and my sister burst into tears. And I just like sat there.
What age was your sister?
She's 2 years older. So I was five-ish. She was like seven. And I think she's always been better at expressing emotions, and I've always been better at bottling up and, no pun intended, and suppressing emotions. And I think I just thought, like, if I can pretend to be okay, this is all going to be okay. And that day just, like, didn't say much of anything.
That's called acting as if.
Yeah, acting as if. I was acting as if everything was okay. And I think I just didn't even realize, like, the internal turmoil of trying to basically, like, it started a pattern of perfectionism that persisted for many years.
So dad lived close by and you saw him a lot?
Yep. So they got, my dad just moved across town, actually closer to my school than my mom's house was. My mom's was like a 10-minute drive from school. My dad bought a house maybe like two blocks from my school. He spent a little time in an apartment first, but eventually landed in that house. So yeah, they lived 10 minutes apart. I spent Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I just messed up the schedule. Whatever. I spent 4 days at my mom's house, 3 days at my dad's house, and I switched every day, which is in some ways a crazy schedule, but I saw both parents all the time.
Right. And they communicated. You never really saw fighting, but everybody wasn't together that much.
Yeah. So I never really saw fighting, but there was just like looking back, there was just a ton of tension all the time, and I was just like living in a state of tension as a result of that, starting in preschool, which is pretty common when you hear recovery stories. Like, I felt like I wasn't that good at making friends. I was thinking about myself all the time. I was nervous. I was anxious. I wasn't good at playing well with others. Like, I remember coming home from preschool and my mom's like, oh, did you make any friends? And I like describe this friend that I made. I'm so excited, and then I tell my mom she has a glass eye, and my mom was like, did you make friends with your teacher? And I was like, yeah. Like, that was the only, I just like was never good at figuring out other kids. So, and it's because I didn't know until I got into recovery, it's all self-centeredness, right? I walked around the world thinking about myself all day long.
Right.
So it makes it hard to make friends with other people.
So you go through nursery, I guess it was preschool.
Yeah.
And you go through elementary school.
Yep.
And any major events between there and when you went to high school? Or
yeah, so I went to a pretty small private school, K through 12. So I switched, obviously, like after preschool, went to private school there. Again, like just felt that sort of internal like trouble making friends. I had sort of one friend in third grade for a while. And then there was another kid who had divorced parents who I started to kind of become friends with in like fourth and fifth grade. He also had a pretty complicated like family home life situation. And we, I think, kind of like bonded over that. AOL Instant Messenger was big. And we used to like message a lot on there. And then in fifth grade, I was coming home from a ski trip with my mom. And we got a call from the school that his mom, there was murder suicide. So his mom had killed him and then committed suicide herself.
Hold on. The mom killed the son? The son
and then committed suicide.
And that was your friend?
Yeah. So that was like my first like close friend, really. So that just kind of like threw me in this tailspin of like the world doesn't make sense. And I think like somehow between the divorce and that, and then right around the same time, like fifth grade-ish, my dad, both my parents had gotten remarried, and my dad and stepmom were like trying to adopt this girl who was a couple years younger than me, and her mom was in hospice. Her dad was in prison, and her mom was in hospice, and her mom died. And then my mom was marrying my stepdad, and his ex-wife died of liver stuff, which is probably alcoholism stuff. Like also at the same time. So it was like this mom, there was like this murder suicide related to a mom, and then this mom died and this mom died. And in my little like fifth grade brain, I was just like, it just imploded. Like just nothing made sense about the world anymore. And I think a lot of the like internalized pain stuff started with just like the confusion of those events.
And were you able to talk about this trauma that you went through? There's, I mean, not that you were the center of it, but it was in your world.
Like they offered grief therapy. I think I went to therapy a little bit, but I was so obsessed with like everything being fine, that acting as if thing, that I really just wanted everything to be fine. And I think I just tried so hard to pretend that everything was fine, that counseling allowed, you have to say things aren't fine if you want to go to counseling. And I think I just was like not interested in doing that. I remember them offering grief counseling, and I think I went to therapy a couple times because I was having really weird nightmares. Separation anxiety disorder is what it got diagnosed as with my mom because of all of this like mom stuff that was happening, where I would like have nightmares that she was dying. Whenever she dropped me off at my dad's house, I would like have these like flashback feeling things that she was going to like die before I saw her again. So I went to therapy a little bit for that. But I think I just was like, I don't like this. And then suffered on for a while.
Right. So that was fifth grade.
Yeah.
And between then, let's take us through like your years before you went to college.
Yeah. So sixth grade, I got cool for the first time in my life.
Well, that's thank God for that.
I know. Thank goodness for that. I don't even know what happened. I literally was in a new homeroom in sixth grade. The school's small, so it's all the same kids. That's what's funnier about it. It's not like I went to middle school and like found myself. And this girl, we were sitting under the table during like reading time, and she just was like, you should sit with me at lunch today. And then those were the cool kids in my grade. And I ended up being a part of this group of friends that were like the cooler girls. And that sort of ended up funneling into eventually like dating older guys and then drinking.
Hold on. So in sixth grade, you meet one of the cool girls.
Yeah.
You become a cool girl.
Become a cool girl.
And how did that translate to dating older guys?
I don't really know. It's just what the people were doing. There was literally in ninth grade, there's a photo of like me and my group of friends, and we're all dating male seniors. Like, and we all, like, it's a prom photo in front of my friend's house, and they were all a group of friends, and they all just like dated us.
So you were ninth grade and you went to prom?
With a senior, yeah.
Well,
my parents were thrilled.
You are cool.
So he was the quarterback too, and we didn't even have football. He just played football for the high school downtown. So we didn't even like have a football team, but I managed to find myself a little quarterback.
He's a quarterback without a football team.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he played for downtown, so it was almost like cooler because he was a public school quarterback.
Got it. Got it.
Private school kids.
Right. Well, I have a lot of funny things in my head, funny metaphors, but I'm not going to go there.
It's a pattern in my life.
Right. So he had no one to toss anything to.
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, so 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, cool.
No, it got a little trickier. So after 8th grade is when I started drinking. So drinking kind of enters the scene. And for me, it was immediately not good. Like, I don't think I ever drank normally in my entire time drinking. So my very first drink, I'll just tell the story because it's funny. My friend Claire calls me. We had those like little Nokia cell phones. Calls me. All right. She was having a party at her house. And my two little friends call me on their Nokia phones and they're like, you should drink. And I'm like, I don't even really know what this means. Like, what's happening? And they were like, 12, just drink 12 ounces. And like hung up the phone. And I'm sure they each had like drank a Coors Light or something. Right. But the only, my parents didn't really drink. But my stepmom did a little bit. And so there was whiskey in the house. And so I, being the perfectionist that I am, took out a measuring cup, like looked both ways in the kitchen, took out a measuring cup, carefully measured 12 ounces of whiskey. I think I just like didn't pay attention in health class. Didn't realize that's like not a thing humans should do. Like measured it, put it in this like opaque water bottle. My sister drove me to the party at my friend's house. I chugged it on the way there. Not that I'm a very big person now, but I was like 5'2 and probably less than 100 pounds then. So I chugged it. Vomit everywhere within like 2 minutes because I've just poisoned myself as far as my body is concerned. But what is like so beautifully problematic about that situation is all the memories are good. Right? Like I barely remember anything. I kind of like browned in and out all night, but I can just remember like feeling free and feeling what I thought was joy for like one of the first times in my life. Like all that tension I talked about, fear of what other, because even once I got cool, I still just lived in fear that I was going to be like not cool one day or people weren't going to like me anymore. And for the first time in my life, I just didn't care.
Right. That's one of the promises, I think.
Yeah. One of the promises of blacking out is you stop caring what people think. You can't think at all. How could
exactly.
You think about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my drinking, so I started that day and it was pretty hard to get alcohol in the beginning. But we would like get, that was part of the dating the older guys. We could get it from them. There was a guy who sold like $20 Deer Park water bottles full of vodka in a cul-de-sac and we would get that some. So 9th grade was like, we were all dating seniors and it was great. And then that group of friends kind of broke up and people went to boarding school and public school and different things. So 10th grade and 11th grade were like a lot different for me. But I feel like there was some weird sort of like glow of like having been cool that sort of like carried me through those. But my drinking started escalating in like 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade. So 10th grade, I got in trouble at school, for drinking before a soccer game. Because I was starting center midfielder in the soccer game and I took like 8 shots of 99 apples before the game and was like stumbling around the field and then somehow convinced everyone it was food poisoning and like didn't get expelled. But it was like, my point is basically my drinking was like already coming out at the seams in...
And the lying.
Yeah, the lying. Yeah, dishonesty. And I guess even, I haven't really thought about this before, but like... Later on, there's like tons of relationship problems that are coming from drinking. But even early on, like my high school boyfriends, I feel like were like, why are you drinking so much? Where did you sleep last night? Why? And I'm like, well, I don't know. And it escalated in college when I had more freedom. But it was pretty bad even in high school. And my friends were always like, please stop blacking out. And they would like drive me home and just leave me at my house.
Please stop blacking out.
Yeah. I wish I could. Flip it off black. I don't want to black out either.
It's like talking to a plant and say, please stop growing.
Yeah. Please stop blacking out. So it was just, it was a mess. Like just much of the time. My mom videoed me one time. Like when I was, someone dropped me off, like blacked out and my mom videoed me to show me in the morning.
What'd that do?
Not a lot. Right?
Like, were you, did you try to explain it away? Or did you just acknowledge it? You know, you owned it.
I mean, you couldn't explain away what was in this video.
Oh, you can. You can. You can explain it away. I mean, we see it on any cable news network. Everything's explained away every day.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I gave some reason, but by that time I was coming home drunk so often and getting in trouble so often. It was almost like that, like you're permanently grounded. So I'm not grounded at all because I'll just sneak out because I'm permanently grounded thing.
Yeah, permanent grounding is like not grounding at all.
Yeah, and then they've sort of switched from like we're mad at you to like we're just disappointed and we really want you to like find something. So my biggest excuse, I guess now that I'm thinking about it, and I don't even know if it was dishonest or if I was genuinely confused, is also in 10th grade, I started my like eating disorder journey is what I was about to call it. But eating disorders and alcoholism have always been closely tied for me. And I was like extremely anorexic during 10th grade, which is like when the soccer thing happened. So I went from like, I was 5'3"-ish back then and like probably 115 when I started to like 88 pounds by December of my sophomore year of high school. So I would just be like, well, I didn't eat today and that's why it's so bad. And
was it diagnosed, the eating disorder?
Yeah.
And so you knew that you had the issue.
Yeah.
Did you do anything with it?
Yeah. So I went to like, I had a therapist, I had a dietitian. There was a whole like eating disorder treatment team. And I think that actually took a lot of the spotlight away from the substances because I would tell my mom the only time that I'll eat is when I'm drunk. Right. I almost got her to keep wine in the house when I was 17 because I convinced her that that was like how I was better at eating and it made me feel calmer. And then I was like better able to eat when I had it.
How long did that last?
She didn't actually do it, but we got close.
Very, very smart.
Parents are that desperate to like help me not die of the eating disorder.
Very smart.
Yeah.
See, the respect that I had for you to start with is now enhanced.
Increasing.
It's like skyrocketed.
Yeah, if only I'd actually gotten all the way there.
Yeah, you didn't quite make it. That's true. But the try is worth everything.
And the irony also. So it eventually like changes from anorexia to binge eating disorder to bulimia. And then I was just like bulimic for many years. But what's so weird is I could never throw up like from drinking.
Right.
But I could make myself throw up as needed to be skinny.
Interesting. Well, you know, it's a question of, you know, what your motivation is.
Yeah, motivated to need to keep my alcohol and to regulate my weight through crazy behavior.
So the insanity of your high school probably directly related to the difficulties earlier.
Yeah.
The loss, the divorce, the trauma that you suffered. There's a nexus there that, you know, is pretty easy to see.
Yeah. But what's crazy is I didn't until like, we'll eventually get there. I come into recovery at 29 years old and I didn't connect any of it. I like literally, like, I feel like the way that people talk about, I never really ended up oddly, I think because the central thing was eating disorders. I never ended up in like an alcohol treatment when I was in high school or college or anything. And people treat it like eating disorders fall out of the sky. They're like, oh, weird. We're going to teach you how to eat eggs again. But they're not like, maybe it's all of the anger and fear that you're carrying from your childhood that is the reason that you're so terrified of egg yolks. Like, no one puts that together.
Right.
It's just like it fell out of the sky. So I really didn't like put any of this together. I mean, early on too, like in preschool, I had a sticker phobia. Like, I was terrified of stickers. Like, my teachers knew not to put them on papers. Like, it was nuts. And then I had OCD with light switches. Like, I couldn't leave the room or I thought my mom was going to die if I didn't flick it 9 times. So there was, like, things coming unscrewed from all the trauma early on. And, what's interesting is, like, those things kind of faded away when I started drinking, when I started obsessing about body image instead of obsessing about light switches.
Interesting.
So
you graduate.
Yeah.
High school, you do well?
I did well. I got 1 B+ from Miss Quinn in 9th grade. Otherwise, I had all A's.
The fuck is wrong with her?
I know.
It's
funny that I still remember European Civilization was a class.
It's really interesting how we remember those things.
Yeah, yeah. I got 1 B in college too. Sociological theory.
You know, it's interesting. Over the years, in recovery, there have been a lot of people that there's a lot of people that we help.
Yeah.
But the people who we couldn't help, the ones who didn't make it, who had some time and then their bodies couldn't take what they went back to, and the ones I really remember are the ones that aren't here anymore.
Yeah.
I wonder why that is. It's a little bit like the B+.
Yeah. I have a couple of those. Like Banana Bread Lori is who comes to mind to me. She always baked banana bread before meetings and stuff. But yeah, you remember those.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's a lot on the other side. So I guess looking at the whole picture is really important.
Yeah.
Gratitude. For all the good things that we have.
Yeah.
So you graduate with honors.
Yep.
And you go to college.
I went to college.
Mama is a Princeton lady. You're not going to go get a job at the, you know, around the corner or anything.
No, I got an interview at Princeton, but I didn't get in. They also sent this like very attractive guy. I was just telling my husband this yesterday. I don't know how he felt about this, but we were walking around Princeton and I was like, they sent this really attractive guy to interview him. And I feel like that wasn't fair. He was like a football player from Princeton. And I was like, this is like not a fair, I can't speak, but it's not because.
Right. You stuttered a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, send me like a field hockey girl or something.
Exactly.
Like, this is, yeah.
That would have been better.
I don't think I was getting in anyway. But yeah, so I graduate high school. And I actually, basically because of the eating disorder, had gotten really good at running, as many anorexic women do, because we get exercise compulsions and we start running all the time. So I actually went to University of Richmond in Virginia to run track and cross country for them at the Division I level.
Wow.
Because of my eating disorder. So that's sort of great in its own way. And then I had, it's not exactly an athletic scholarship, but colleges sometimes like give you, my mom's always like, it was because of your merit too. So, but the coach helped me get it. So I got like 30 grand a year related to my eating disorder. So there are gifts of compulsions, even though most of the,
so you got some scholarship money. Mommy's proud.
Yeah. Yep. So went there to run, and the fall of my freshman year, my leg broke. And I say it that way only because I didn't break my leg. I didn't fall. I didn't run into anything. I was just so malnourished and drinking so much that my bones were just like, hey, you can't run 90 miles a week and not eat and do what you're doing.
Did it happen during a practice or a race?
Yeah, so I had gotten, what they think happened is I had a stress fracture and then I just kept running on it because I didn't want to complain about pain. And so it cracked. It ended up cracking like 3/4 of the way through my shin.
Wow.
So then I was done running, at least for a while.
Pain medication?
Not really. I don't remember any. I know I struggled a little bit with that in high school. It's hard for me to remember for whatever reason. And I don't think I'm just like blocking it out. But I know I used to like steal some from my parents in high school. I don't really remember in college. Probably it was just too hard to get. But I started drinking a ton after I quit. And that's a great pain medication also. So yeah, not a ton. I was in a boot. But I don't remember any like prescription meds.
Do you remember that being difficult, being in a boot or in a cast or that kind of stuff? Because I was, for the first time in my life, I had a cast this year.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, I usually look at these things that people have and I say, well, they'll get better, you know.
Yeah.
I give it such short thrift, I don't even notice it.
Yeah.
When you have it on your own body, oh my goodness, it's horrible.
Yeah. I think it was annoying in class. It was like a very much a walking campus, so I think it was a little bit annoying to walk around.
But, such a baby.
Yeah, I don't remember it that much more than that.
Yeah. All right, well, forget about it. Let's not talk about me anymore, okay?
So my leg breaks. So I ended up basically joining a sorority. The coach wasn't super pleased that I joined a sorority. She was probably right for not being pleased. And we ended up parting ways, and I went the route of sorority instead.
Sorority instead of athlete.
Yeah.
Okay, junior year, sophomore year?
Freshman year. So by freshman spring, I just rushed and joined a sorority instead.
Okay.
Got to retain the scholarship because it wasn't directly related to me running. And then actually ended up getting a bunch more through my sorority because, similar to high school, I graduated college with like a 3.9, I think, and was like simultaneously like scholarship chair of my sorority, won all the academic awards because no one in my sorority besides me was getting like a near 4.0.
Were you able to get good grades during?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I had that 1B
in college.
Sophomore year. Yeah, I had 1B sophomore year. But other than that.
Now, when you say 1B, the implicit in that is everything else was A's.
Everything else was A's.
Really?
I think I had my college, I can't remember. Like, it's either like 3.88 or like 3.92. It's either side of 3.9 was my GPA.
Wow.
So I always like did everything I needed to do well in class and was just like completely blacked out the rest of the time. Like whenever I would go, we would have like scholarship banquets and I would go up to collect my awards. everyone in my sorority was like, I thought you just blacked out. Like, I don't understand. You are also doing well in school. And I'm like, I don't know. It's just happening.
One of those feathers in your cap.
Yeah, it's just. And I would choose, like, I think I would still have chosen psychology now. But I know I chose things that I was good at and I was interested in because it was just very easy to get A's in those things. Like, I don't know if I would have wanted to go to med school, but I think I couldn't have drank as much if I, like, needed to take organic chemistry and show up to labs and stuff. So I just didn't take the kinds of classes that I would need to, like, have that.
Right. You took things that allowed you to do the social things and, you know, the using things that you could still do and still maintain high grades.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, I don't think that part of the story is, I think, pretty typical of the way we manipulate the world around us to be able to say that we're okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was trying my hardest. So it's like that was happening. I was also blacking out all the time. I was also on sorority probation often. Like the one
who put you on sorority probation, the sorority
puts you on sorority probation.
The your peers.
Yeah, well, your peers and like there's people that oversee the sorority so it doesn't fall apart. And those people, there's like one day a year that you're supposed to be sober at a social event, and obviously I couldn't do that. So I not only wasn't sober, but blacked out. And then the people who have the job of being sober had to care for me because I was way too drunk. So, yeah, you get in trouble when you behave that way.
Right.
Yeah. You're allowed to drink, I feel like. You're just not allowed to cause problems, and my drinking almost always caused problems.
Right.
So.
So you graduate college.
Graduated college.
And your grades were good, and you meet wonderful people, sorority sisters.
Yep.
And some of them are still your friends today, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So what? So you go on to any school after?
Yep. So I went straight to graduate school. So during my sophomore, junior, senior year, I was doing research with professors there, and like was writing papers with them, like academic publications that were going out into the world. So I went straight to a PhD program when I graduated college. And that's how I ended up in Minnesota. So this is now 2013. I graduated college in May and then moved to Minnesota in August to start a PhD program.
In Minnesota because you got into school in Minnesota.
Minnesota because it's weirdly ranked very high for a PhD in psychology. I was like not pleased. So I like got into Duke first and I think it was ranked like 10th at the time for a PhD in psychology. But Minnesota was, I don't know, 4th or 5th.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is today. But.
So it was an academic choice, that it was a really good school.
Yep. And then there were two professors there. So my degree's in social psychology, and there's lots of, like, you can study politics, you can study relationships, you can study health. And I wanted to study health and eating behavior because I was fascinated with why I couldn't figure out how to eat like a normal person. So there was people who did that at University of Minnesota. So that's why I chose there.
And you got a master's there?
I got a PhD there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How many years?
6.
Holy crap.
Yep. So my whole 20s, 22 to 28, I was.
Mom must have been really proud.
Yeah. I thought I was proud too.
Well, you were doing good things. Yeah. It wasn't all bad.
Yeah. It was like the same pattern the whole time. Good things were happening and problematic things were happening.
So at some point.
Yeah.
We have a twist in the story. A bottom, sometimes we call it.
Yep.
So you want to take us along that road?
Yeah. So I'll start by saying, like, I feel like the bottom sort of started to evolve when I was in college. So my first ever experience of people being like, you have a problem with drinking, you need to figure out, was in college. A few girls I was really good friends with after, like, a particularly bad night. This was April of my senior year. And actually my first hospitalization because of alcohol was February of my senior year of college. So things were like devolving in the spring of that senior year. They pulled me aside and were like, something's wrong with you. We don't know what it is, but like your drinking's worse than it's ever been. And I was kind of like, you guys drink too. Like, this isn't what's even happening here. And they were like,
You didn't notice the difference. They did.
I think I did. I think I just liked excuses. I mean, like, I knew I blacked out all the time, and I didn't, like, most alcoholics, I think, like, I didn't want to black out all the time. I just kept not being able to not black out.
I remember wanting to get the answer from the people I was using with.
Yeah.
I was hoping that they would provide the answer as to how it is I'm supposed to get my stuff together.
Yeah.
And they didn't know. They were doing it with me.
Yeah.
But they were, the ones you were with kind of knew that there was a difference between your behavior and mine. The crowd I was running in were, you know, they weren't so far away. I was worse.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was no answers to be had in that environment.
Yeah. These, I think, were like genuine regular drinkers. And not that everyone in my whole sorority was, but the people who pulled me at the close friends who pulled me aside at the end. I think like looking at their drinking, they're just regular, take it or leave it kind of people, which I think is why they could see that like something was really off in what was happening with me. And also like there was consequences building up. Like I somehow, bless his heart, had a boyfriend for most of college, and I would just black out, wake up in a fraternity house, not know where I was, wake up over here, wake up over there. We would fight about it. Somehow we wouldn't break up. Then we would break up, get back to, right? Like, it was nuts that he just like kept coming back. I feel like he loved me the way you like love a stray dog. I'm not really sure, but where you're like, oh, there's like something wrong here, but I just love her and I don't know why.
Right.
But I mean, I've made amends to him now, but like the trauma I must have caused him. So, and none of my other friends were like blacking out and waking up in places where they didn't know, or occasionally maybe that was happening, but that wasn't happening like every weekend and just causing all these problems. So yeah, so it was different, I think. And so the two of them had pulled me aside. One of them, her dad was in recovery in Boston, and so they were like, he said to take you to a meeting, so we're gonna go to a meeting. So they took me to a recovery meeting, and I walked in.
This is what year?
This is senior year of college.
Okay.
So this is 2013.
So your first meeting ever
is
in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
we know that you continued drinking thereafter.
For 7 more years.
So what was the first meeting like for you? Was it a I'm not like them kind of meeting?
100%. So I made us drive really far away from Richmond, or at least really far in my head, is probably 20 minutes, because I didn't want to see anyone I knew. I don't know who I thought going to see there. Everyone I know drinks. No one would be at that meeting. But we drive to this meeting, and it was just like what I remember is like old rural farmers with no teeth. They were probably like 35 and they had all their teeth, but I just like couldn't see similarities because I wasn't ready.
Right.
So that was May. And then I don't really remember that summer, but I moved to Minnesota in August and like moved in with two girls I didn't know who were also starting grad school, made some friends. And that first weekend in Minnesota, I like drank way too much per always. And then they were also normal people who were like, are you okay? Like what? And I'm like, oh, this has never happened. Right. Like you don't say like, oh, this actually happens every weekend. I thought it would be better now that I like live in the tundra. And so I took myself actually to my second ever meeting that Sunday night at a club that I still go to now. And like, I just remember being hungover and like sweating a lot. And what I remember from that night is hearing, I know it's one day at a time, but I remember hearing like these people never drank again. And I was like, I'm not that bad. Like, I don't need that. I don't need to never drink again. I just need to not.
You just need to learn how to do it so you don't it doesn't get out of hand.
Yeah. Like this is extreme. And they gave me a big book and they put a little pamphlet in it and I left and I didn't come back for 7 years. But I never threw away that book. Like, it's still, I feel like, part of the journey is, like, that book. And I moved probably, like, 7 times.
Do you have the book now?
I don't think I have that copy of it anymore. I don't know where it went. But it followed me until I came back in 2020. So the getting to the bottom, though. So I finished grad school. Basically, like, by the grace of God, which I didn't even believe God existed back then.
He might not. Back then, it probably didn't exist.
Yeah, he didn't exist.
Yeah.
He came online in 2020.
It was pretty much with the pandemic.
Yeah.
And enter. You know.
That's, yeah. So I found this boyfriend. So men trying to save me is part of the whole journey. I found this boyfriend who gave me a drinking ultimatum, who was like, you can't, like, I'm going to break up with you if you don't stop drinking. And this is like 2 months before I'm going to finish grad school. And I need to finish writing this 200 page dissertation.
Good timing.
Yeah. So he babysits me basically for 2 months. I finish the paper, turn it in. I was actually just looking through old photos of my phone. And there's a picture of me drinking a Manhattan on the rooftop of this bar, like as soon as I turned it in. Because I convinced him that like I was just so stressed about the dissertation needing to be turned in. That's why my drinking was bad. And that day, I remember I drank like 7 Manhattans and like face planted on that roof. And I didn't prove my point very well.
Right.
Yeah, turns out I
had that relationship end.
He actually, people stay. I don't know why. He actually stayed for a while. So shortly after that, after I finished my PhD, I moved to Chicago to do a postdoctoral fellowship at Northwestern School of Medicine. And we stayed together when I first moved to Chicago. But I was like blacking out and losing my phone and sleeping with other people. And
didn't work.
He didn't like that. Yeah.
There are certain things that tend to annoy boyfriends and girlfriends about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The drinking is towards the top of the list, but not being faithful, maybe a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got it.
Yeah.
So you're in Chicago, still drinking.
Yep.
You've been to meetings now in Virginia.
Yep.
Minnesota.
Yep.
You find meetings in Chicago?
I did not.
So you do the whole postdoctoral thing is while you're drinking 2020, 2021?
So 2019, I started the fellowship. So I moved to September and August. And then the world shuts down in March-ish of that year. So it had gotten pretty bad. January, February, I had a work trip where I was in New Orleans and then I was in Austin. I got COVID, I think. I couldn't smell or taste when I came back, but COVID wasn't really like cool yet. So I didn't know that that's what I had. So I had come back to Chicago. And like my drinking was, I would say, devolving to a point where I don't know if you can actually like lose a job as a postdoctoral fellow because Northwestern wasn't even paying me. The National Institute of Health was paying me. But if you could lose a job, I feel like I was getting close because in grad school, you don't have to show up 9 to 5. This was like out of medical school. I was supposed to take the train, show up at 9 every day. And I had never had to do that before. And it became very evident that if I had had to do that in the past, I would not have had a job. And I just like couldn't hold it together. And then by mid-March, I get back from this trip. And like, I don't have to go to work anymore because we worked on interventions with cancer patients. Cancer patients can't do anything during the pandemic. So everything becomes remote. And my workload became very small because there just wasn't as much to do. And my drinking then, like it had always been like I was drinking every night on weeknights, but I was just like sobering up just enough for the day. Maybe like a few little sips in the morning to like help it wear off, but not like all day. And then by March of 2020, when I didn't have to go to work anymore, it was like all day. And I was pretty much leaving the house just to like go get box wine at Trader Joe's and like bring it back and just like keep drinking all day long. So for the first time in my life, I mean, it had been all day for like 5 days over long weekends before, 3 days over long weekends and stuff like that. But it had never been like all day, 7 days a week.
So in the early part of the pandemic, drinking accelerates, work kind of goes away.
Yep.
And was there a particular event that intervened?
Not really, which is kind of weird. There was just, I woke up one morning. So I was also trying to date during that time. I'm like on all these dating apps. I'm showing up to dates blacked out. And I came home.
During COVID.
During COVID.
Yeah.
When you, those are addicts, right? I'm like, I need booze. I need men. I need, these are the things that are going to solve my problems. Also, my bathroom broke at one point. And so I was also dating people to sleep at their house if they had bathrooms, which I've never shared publicly before, so you can take or leave that as you will.
All right, well, you've heard it here.
You heard it here first.
The toilet broke.
So I was nuts, right? Just like nothing in my life actually made sense at that point. So I wake up one morning, and my bed was on these little like riser things so that you could put more stuff under it because I was in a pretty small studio apartment in Chicago. And I woke up this one morning and the bed had like fallen off of some of them. So I'm like tipped sideways in the bed. I have peed the bed. It's also that time of the month. So there's like blood and pee and the bed is sideways and I'm hungover. And I was just like, something has to change.
But otherwise, everything is fine.
Yeah, otherwise everything's great. But yeah, it was just, I think I knew that like internally I was devolving.
Yep.
And I think there was a part of me that like almost wanted, I mean, I wasn't driving really anywhere in Chicago, but like wanted a DUI or wanted like, I'd even had police interactions in Chicago, but I was blonde then. I was going to say I'm a little blonde girl and I'm a brunette girl, but I was like a little blonde girl and they would just like bring me home. Right. Right. I'm no arrest, no anything. Even I got stopped once in Minnesota while I was drinking and he was like, just get to your destination. Like so many times there were like, it's almost like I wanted something to fall apart and things just like weren't falling apart. And I woke up that morning in Chicago and I was like, I don't know what to do, but I have to be done. And I just started driving back to Minneapolis. I just like put stuff in the car. I probably wasn't even sober, honestly, given how much I was drinking, but put all my stuff in the car and just started driving back toward Minneapolis. Like I didn't even know where I was going.
You didn't have a place that you lived.
No, I just couldn't. I just thought Chicago was the problem.
Right.
It had made it worse than ever. And I was like, it's the pandemic and my apartment's too small and whatever. So I just start driving back. I always joke like this is not a great decision making mode. So I end up calling my ex-boyfriend who I had dated for like most of the time that I was in Minneapolis and was like, hey, can I stay with you? Like I'm going crazy in Chicago because there's just more room in Minneapolis. I imagine it kind of like being in New York during the pandemic. Everyone just like feels on top of each other. And there's just like in Minnesota, there's more space and everyone. It was getting closer to summer by that point, like April. Anyway, he said yes. So
this is the same one that you had broken up with?
No, this is actually a different one.
Okay.
Yeah. So that one,
if you don't mind, yeah. I'm just going to get a scorecard.
Yeah. There's a lot over the years. I stood on the shoulders of a lot of men. That's probably not how that should be said, but like who kept me from hitting different bottoms at different points.
So you go back to Minneapolis.
This guy actually owns a bunch of cannabis farms across the
okay
mostly
but upper. he's not a using person.
I mean he like smokes a lot. He's a normal guy. Anyone who sells cannabis yeah. smokes a lot of cannabis. But yeah, so he again has the ability. I mean when I was dating him I drank too much all the time. But I had come back, this is I think now like early May, go to stay with him. And after a couple of weeks of me being there, he then pulls me aside and is like, you've always drank too much, but I've never seen it like this. Like, you can't stay here if this is all that you're going to do. Because he was watching me drink like 24 hours a day in his house, hiding it from him, like whatever. He's like, you can't be here anymore. So as a good alcoholic does, I got mad. This was like right before Memorial Day weekend. I got mad at him. There's a lake called Lake Minnetonka where there's just people like partying all the time in the summer in Minnesota. I went to the lake, went on this like 5-day bender and then like woke up at a party actually on the like Tuesday after Memorial Day. I was supposed to be on meetings for work. I just like didn't even know where my laptop was, didn't know where my car was. That was the day I almost got a DUI and didn't. And like that morning, my friends like came downstairs, was pouring wine. He probably is an alcoholic, but was pouring wine into a coffee cup. It's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said, do you want some? And for me, the answer is always yes. Like I absolutely do. Especially if you're going to make it normal by you drinking also and not me by myself at 8 a.m. And for some reason, I just like said no. Like I woke up that morning and like knew that I was done. And of course my sobriety date doesn't come for 7 months, but within a couple of days of that I called one of those girls from college who's actually married to someone who's sober now, and was like, I don't know what to do anymore, like can you put Mike on the phone? And he gets on the phone and is like, go to a meeting. And I was like, I tried those meetings. I don't want to go to those meetings, they suck, like they're not for me. And he was like, I've got nothing for you then. So I like detoxed just on the couch for a couple more days. The boyfriend had let me like come back once I said that I was going to try to get sober. And by that Thursday, went to my first meeting. It was on Zoom because it was during the pandemic. By that Sunday, had my first sponsor and then like started my actual journey in recovery.
So you really, started on Zoom during mm-hmm. the pandemic.
Yeah.
But you said it was 7 months until you got your sober date.
Mm-hmm.
So you had some different experiences that you fell off a few times?
Yeah, kind of. I first had a lot of trouble admitting that like addiction is everything. So I was willing to admit that I had an alcohol problem, but I was not willing at first to admit that I had an anything else problem.
What's that mean?
Oh, like anything. Weed, mushrooms, LSD, cocaine. Like they were all still like fair play in my mind, which of course keeps extending your sobriety date. Whether I like it or not, that's what was happening.
Well, alcohol was the thing that you were at most, most of the time. You wanted to keep something in your back pocket.
Well, it's like as soon as the alcohol was gone, I was absolutely miserable. And so I needed something else immediately. I didn't realize that if you actually like do a program of recovery, you can get to a point where you can just live in the world.
And be happy.
And be happy. Yeah. Yeah, right. I can just live in the world anxious without a program of recovery. Right. But yeah, so that's what took. So I first, as people do, I found a sponsor who was young and cool, and I didn't want to believe in God because I was too smart because I had a PhD, and she didn't believe in God, and she told me that I could be resent anyone I wanted if it was justified, and it was a whole mess. But she was sober, and I like, it's all part of the journey, right? Like I think if I had gone from where I was to like finding someone like the sponsor I have today, I would have thought she was absolutely insane. So to have,
it was good. It was,
yeah. To have this person as a stepping stone to just show me that it was like possible to not drink, and still live, I think was important, but it was just not the level of recovery that I was eventually going to need. So what happens is she's my sponsor for a while. I'm meeting with her weekly. I'm going to meetings all the time. My home group is actually the Hollywood Young People's Meeting out of Los Angeles because I thought it seemed cool. And I was like, everything's on Zoom anyway. I've actually gone to visit them like since I, you know, a couple years later. Be like, nice. Hey, this is so fun. You guys are my original home group. But so I was doing it like mostly online and had the sponsor. But I was like showing up and doing the things and like doing the steps of recovery. But I was doing them all without a higher power. And I have come to learn that for me, that is doesn't get me to the point that I need to be at. To I think in the end, it was going to be actually stay sober. So I get to December of 2020, and I was more miserable than I had ever been in my entire life. Like drinking or not drinking, hungover or not hungover. By December of that year, I mostly had stopped. Like I was sober. So I had finally been convinced. I don't even know. There were so many weird things that like Fenibut was this weird thing I was ordering on the internet that definitely doesn't count as sober. So I'd gotten like all of those out of my system, and then realized how like anxious, confused, miserable. So I just start like collecting all these diagnoses, right? Like, oh, I have generalized anxiety disorder. I have panic disorder. I have whatever. So I was having daily panic attacks.
What does collecting them mean?
Like over, like, I just mean, I'm like going to a psychologist and being like, there's something wrong with me. And they're like, oh yes, you're anxious. But like, I'm not seeing that as like something that can be dealt with in recovery. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing that as like, okay, I'm going to need this medication for this and this medication for this. And it was kind of just nutty. And I get to December of that year. And for me,
we're December 2020.
December 2020. So like 6-7 months into this journey that I'm trying. And one of actually the reasons why I was always afraid to get sober was because every time I'd stopped drinking in the past, the eating disorder got worse. So like those 2 months when I was finishing my dissertation, I vomited, I think like every day, like binged and threw up every day. So the eating, because it's just another way of coping with all the stuff that was all the fear, all the anger, all the whatever. So as soon as I stopped drinking, I'm back in those. So I'd always been afraid of that. And that is exactly what had happened. By December of 2020, I was having a panic attack every day. So my anxiety is just all over the place. I was binging and purging like 4 or 5 times a day. So I'm spending the whole day just like eating a gallon of ice cream, throwing it up. And there is like a release that comes in that's very much like addiction. And so my life, I was at this point where I'm why am I even alive?
Nothing changed.
Yeah. Why even be sober if my life is going to be this? So I don't ever know that I had like, I have friends who have had like suicidal obsession where like that's all that you can think about. And I don't think that I ever got to the point where I would say that I had a suicidal obsession, but I definitely was in a place of like, I don't understand what the point of being alive is if this is what sobriety is. And that is when I basically became open-minded enough to try this new meeting. People kept telling me, like, you got to try this other meeting. You got, because I was only going to young people's meetings where everyone, like, doesn't do God and we're all cool and angsty and have a lot of piercings, although I didn't have a lot of piercings. And people were like, go to this meeting. Like, there's old timers there, whatever. And I was like, I don't know. It was at 6:30 in the morning. And I was like, not a morning person. No. And then Christmas Eve of 2020, I had like an overnight panic attack thing. So I was up at 6 a.m. anyway, Christmas morning. And I was like, all right, we're going to go for it.
It was a physical meeting or an online meeting?
Physical meeting.
Okay.
So it was one of the only in-person meetings happening in Minneapolis at the time. It was in a warehouse instead of in like a church or something. So I think they just like weren't doing the policies that anywhere else was. So I go, there's like 40 people in there on Christmas morning. So I go to this in-person meeting. It's like a snowstorm, like doesn't even matter. I've already committed. I'm awake. I'm going. I walk into this meeting late because I sat outside for a while after I get all the way there. And then I'm like, it's Christmas morning. Like probably only like loser people are here. Like who else is going to have nothing to do Christmas morning? Like this is going to suck. So I finally get myself to go in. And then like, I don't know how to explain it except like something about me, I think had like hit a real rock bottom that I like became open-minded that day. And that meeting remains my home group today. That meeting, like people freely use the word God. People were very clear that like that's the problem is that I just like wasn't going to do that part of the program. And something like, I just got so curious, I think is the only way that I can explain it. Like I just had this motivation and drive of like, these people have something that I cannot explain, but that there's like this engine pushing me toward. And I started showing up to that meeting every single day. They do a different meeting on Saturdays. It's a Sunday to Friday meeting. And then they all go the same place on Saturday. So I started going every single day. There was like a big book study that was starting associated with that meeting. I started going to that every week. And just like really opening up to really God, in a way that I hadn't before. And then my sobriety date is January 4th of 2021. And that's a day where I had asked someone who went to that meeting, who's now my husband, to the 13th step, to like, what are you doing? Like he's so happy. He's so, I'm like, what do you do? And he was like, I'll show you, hop in the truck. So we like drive to St. Paul, which feels very far away when you're in Minneapolis, and drive up to what I now know to be a church. And we like go to walk in and I'm like,
what are you doing?
Yeah. What, why are we here? What does this have to do with anything? And he's like, just stop talking, follow me. And we went in and I got on my knees and like gave my life to God in the church that day, which is like, not only did I not want anything to do with God, I especially didn't want anything to do with like a God that looked like that. And it was a Catholic church, so it wasn't just like a cross that was up front. I don't know if you've ever been in a Catholic church, but yeah. There's like a bloody, the whole bloody thing is hanging on, like Jesus's whole body is hanging there. And I've like been, didn't have a ton of exposure to Catholic churches, so this is like just so extra, right? And it's one of those ones where there's like velvet on everything and the kneelers and I'm right up front. But I like, God is present everywhere, right? I by no means think that I had to be inside of that building for that to happen, but something happened inside of that building that day where I like felt something that I now describe as God's grace. I would never have even used that word at the time. But that I now know like that's what was moving.
You were ready.
I was ready. That's what was moving that day. And that date is now my sobriety date. I, of course, didn't know that day that that date was going to be my sobriety date. Right. But
you know, at the end of the day, it really is all about us and when we are ready to accept those things that are real about us, the truth about us, the things that everybody's been telling us along the way. And we said, no, 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 but you don't understand.
Yeah.
And you know, there it is.
Yeah. To be able to say, like, I was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that's all it is.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oops.
It's a big oopsie daisy.
I was wrong about everything.
It's a big oopsie daisy.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wrong. Sorry, everyone.
Oh, I don't think I've cracked up doing an interview yet, but so you not only do you find God, and you have a sobriety date, you find a husband.
I found a husband.
How's that going?
It's going great. He was not that wasn't part of the plan begin with. In some ways, I think it's actually pretty cool because he's heard my whole fifth step. So there's no secrets in the household. Like, he knows the entire history, like all the patterns, all the relationships, all the everything that happened, which is actually pretty cool. And it's also, he was the one who like really explained the pieces of the steps that were missing to me, which you don't have to marry someone for that to be the case. But it's cool looking back to be able to like have had those experiences. Like, he was one of the first people that we were like driving in the truck was like a big, I mean, he puts people in the truck who he's not married to all the time. But just like drive people around, cause you don't have to like make eye contact. You can talk about whatever you need and just like look at the road. And he told me to bring my fourth step one day. And we're in the truck and he's like, there's a prayer that's in this, that's about like, this is not just a list of people that you resent. This is a list of people that you're going to ask God's help to forgive. This is a list of people where like you need forgiveness for your resentment toward them. Like, this is what the prayer is for. And I started praying this prayer and I didn't know that it was possible. Like, I understood in the intellectual concept of forgiveness, like to let go of the past. I thought that I had been forgiving. I couldn't figure out how to do it. For me, I guess I just like needed God's help to do it. But to look at that sheet of paper and people that I like thought I hated or people that I thought I like, it was nuts. Like, to just look at it and be like, I think it's all okay. And some of them, it didn't happen like as quickly as I'd want. Some of them I had to pray for several weeks in order to like get to that place. But to just like be able to unlock all of this stuff. And for the first time in my life, like, that's what really changed for me, is it wasn't just, I had figured out how to not drink. It's just, I had to like vomit all day and have panic attacks and all of that. Mm-hmm. But the shift that happened when I let God and prayer be part of my program is that like, I was sober and I wasn't throwing up anymore. Like, I was sober and I had let go of the anxiety medication that I was on. Like, I was sober and I wasn't anxious all day long anymore. And that was like, that's the part that was nuts.
What a change.
Yeah.
And so in your recovery, you have used your vast educational knowledge to do something productive, to share what you've learned with the world.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what's your crazy harebrained scheme.
Yeah. It's an accident. I feel like all good things are. I think my brain is actually, the one thing I've learned is my brain produces a lot of thoughts. A lot of them are not useful. So in the end, what I do now is actually mostly like be a recovery faith influencer. And then I ended up writing a book, and that all came out of an accident, essentially. I joined like a women's group of sorts, and we were doing this study on like gifts from God, on like, there's a whole little survey thing that you can take, whatever. And mine came up as writing. And I was like, and one of the big things in this, like, I don't know, inventory of what God's gifts might be for you, is that like, if you're super well trained in something, it might come up as a gift, even though it's not a gift. And I was like, I have a PhD. I'm just really well trained in writing. It has nothing to do with being a gift. And there's this like 70-year-old lady named Sandy who lives in Kentucky, who is my mentor in this program. And she was like, no, it's writing. And I was like, it's not, Sandy. Like, and she was like, it's writing and you're going to try it. And that was just like, start writing about like spirituality stuff instead of writing about science, which is what I had done my whole life. And so I sat down, said a prayer and was like, God, just like speak through. What do you want me to do? And it turned out to be this sort of like 750-ish word essay, like a little 3-page essay on, I can't even remember. I think it was gratitude. And then like the next Thursday I sat down and did it again, and it was like the same length but on a completely different topic that I've been like thinking about in recovery. And so every Thursday I started writing a little essay, and I was texting out a Google, so I was writing it in Google Docs and texting a link to like my sponsees, my friends, whatever. And then I was started texting it to like people to tell other people, and then there was like 50 people that I was having to text this thing out to. And so I sent everyone a text one week that was like, hey, I'm just going to put these on Instagram, and then you guys can just go read them on Instagram, and then I don't have to send them to you all. You can just go, like, it was just, I didn't know how to build a website. It was just a centralized place to like put these things that I was writing. And then strangers who I didn't know started also following the essays. And then I realized that if I wanted strangers to follow, I was going to have to make videos and stuff, because people don't just read.
Now, I just want to stop a second. Yeah. Everything you say makes sense.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that you said strangers that you don't know.
True, because there are not strangers that I do know.
But pardon me for pointing it out.
Yeah, no, that's good. People I don't know.
That's a yogi. That actually could be in Yogi's book.
Yeah. Strangers
yeah,
I don't.
Yeah, that's the title.
Book, my second book is going to be called Strangers I Don't Know.
Exactly. Perfect.
All we do is sit here and talk about how the hell we got to where we are. And people like to know, we live by stories. You were talking about one of the chapters in the book is about stories.
Yeah.
Everybody's story is different. Everybody's face is different. Everybody's fingerprint is different.
Yeah.
And we learn from each other.
That's how we do it. Right. If you don't like this episode, try a different episode. Someone totally different. Don't leave the podcast. Just go to a different episode and it'll be fine.
That's right. It's just like the churches and the pews the different meetings. Different meetings. You find one that you like.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks so much, Lisa. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Thank you.